You're listening to the Fertility Docs Uncensored podcast, featuring insight on all things fertility from some of the top-rated doctors around America. Whether you're struggling to conceive or just planning for your future family, we're here to guide you every step of the way.
Hello, welcome back to another fantabulous episode of Fertility Docs Uncensored. I am your host, Dr. Carrie Beaton from the Fertility Center of Las Vegas, and I am joined by my two simply sensational co-hosts, Dr. Abby Eblin from Nashville Fertility Center.
Hey, everybody.
And Dr. Susan Hudson from Texas Fertility Center. How are you girls doing?
We are good. We are good.
Doing great.
What have you been up to lately?
So this has been the week of doing various talks and attending various events that I don't normally do. Like I am, out of the three of us, I'm kind of the homebody, I think.
I think you're more the one that goes out and does stuff.
Well, I'm not the extroverted one, that's for sure. so I gave a talk at the American Bar Association, and then I went to a fundraiser for one of the advocate societies, the Nevada Fertility Advocates, this weekend. And so it was just like meeting all these people that I normally never have any cause to run across. And so it was really kind of fun.
So you sent me a picture of your outfit for one of these events, and I'm sure you made a sensational entrance in this outfit.
Well, sort of, because it's one of, so what I got is that you can find anything on Amazon. And
that's true.
So I found this dress that it's super cute. It's kind of like the skater style dress, and ever important, it has pockets.
Of course.
Skater style dress. What does that mean?
So that's like a sleeveless dress with kind of a nice floof skirt where if you spin, it goes out very nicely.
I got it now. Okay. Yeah.
Like roller skating.
Yes.
Not like skating in the Olympics is what I was envisioning.
Yeah. No ice skating dresses. There was nothing sheer about it, and it covered all the things.
All the parts. Okay. Good. Yes.
And so the dress itself is a gray background, and then there are these cute little patterns on it and like a real light blue and a cute pink. Well, when you actually look closely at the patterns, they are eggs and sperm.
Oh my gosh. Where did you find that? On Amazon?
Amazon.
Did you go on Amazon and said, can you find me an eggs and sperm dress? Like do you search to get this to pull up in your search profile?
So, I mean, you have to consider with whatever technology is spying on us, they know what we type in regularly. And so as an REI, there are things that are not suitable for work anywhere else, but my job, our jobs, I should say. And it was like, I forget what I typed in. It was like egg and sperm dress or OBGYN dress or...
I gotta try this out right now.
I'm doing it right now, Susan. I'm beating you to it. I'm already at Amazon typing this in.
So I also had help because I knew it was out there because one of my staff members had found it. And she is my source for wild and crazy outfit things. And so I knew it existed. And so I knew if I kept going for it because it, and I think the name of the brand was like Cow, something like that.
Okay. When you had yours on, it looked longer.
No, it's like
But when the model is like that, like mid thigh.
No. There's one without pockets and there's one with pockets. The one with pockets is for ladies of a certain age.
Ah, okay.
I.e. my age.
With pockets. Okay.
You're going to have to send me the picture because I can't find it on Amazon.
I will. It's really and so I had like this event that I was at last night for the charity dinner was the person whose house it was at, the husband was standing there and he was taking a picture of a couple of us. And all of a sudden he's like, wait a minute. And he like leans forward and his jaw drops and he's like, your dress. Nope, not quite. I will send you the link, Abby.
Okay.
Oh my goodness.
I just held up a dress with eggs on it to carry,
the purple and green one. You know, red hair, purple and green.
Yeah.
I might need to get one.
I'm thinking about ordering another one or two because they're super cheap and they're super, like, most of the people didn't recognize it. So when I was talking at the American Bar Association, the we had been talking about as a group for our panel getting shirts that say vagina, 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 because the speakers on the panel are all professors of various types. And so we all make our students say all of the female anatomy and genitalia and male anatomy and genitalia so that they get the giggles out. And so we were going to do that. And so the speaker before me was like, okay, so this is what we were going to do. We didn't end up pulling it off, but Dr. Bedian understood the assignment. And so most people didn't catch it. And then afterwards, when I was talking to people, you could kind of see the light of recognition. Oh my God, what is she wearing?
That is hilarious. I think if we appear together somewhere, we should all wear a similar type dress and just see if anybody notices or anything.
I'll be okay with that.
I'm inspired.
The only analogy I have in terms of articles of clothing that you really can't wear anywhere out is one time for one of our Christmas parties, one of our staff members made a shirt for all the doctors and it had all of our pictures on the front and it said, knocking up Nashville since 1992 at Nashville Fertility Center.
Nice. That's awesome.
But I haven't really worn it out anywhere because it's, you know, it would kind of be a little odd in the supermarket line.
I don't think it's as odd as you think, but
okay, questions.
Yes, we are doing a question episode all about what to do when IVF doesn't necessarily go the way we want. All right. So our first question is, I am 41 years old and have one child conceived naturally. He's 2. Life took a turn after he was born and had 4 surgeries, back surgery and double mastectomy. Finally received the all clear and started trying with Clomid, miscarried at 7 weeks, and then began IVF. Unfortunately, was unsuccessful. AMH is higher than average for her age, 2.2. All other levels normal. She has fibroids. Unfortunately, at egg retrieval, they couldn't get to the left ovary because of a fibroid. They took 5 eggs, 4 fertilized, had 2 embryos. PGT testing discovered both embryos were missing chromosomes. She's devastated and anxious to begin another cycle. Really want the doctor to be able to get all of my eggs from my left ovary and understand they may have to go in abdominally. What would you recommend to make this next one better? Husband's sperm has been tested several times and is healthy. We are considering testing his sperm DNA fragmentation. Husband is 52 years old. Thank you for giving us hope.
How old is she, did she say?
41.
Okay. And she had her son several years ago?
2 years ago.
2 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, the best way that I've found to deal with fibroids that are really obstructing an ovary is to try and, number one, make sure your bowels are as empty as possible so that that's not complicating things. And 2, myomectomies. Like I've never been able to really find a good technique abdominally to go through without it being really scary. So I don't do that. I don't know if any of you girls do.
Yeah, we do. But the problem going abdominally is, I always tell patients, it's like a fulcrum effect. When you go through the vagina, the vaginal wall is really thin. And so you can manipulate and maneuver your needle a lot easier and get to the more follicles. When you go through abdominally, and it depends on how heavy the patient is. I mean, number one, it's really hard to see. And, you know, quite frankly, it's a little scarier because we don't typically do that all the time. Mm-hmm. And when you go in, you have a straight shot and you can't really get to a lot of different eggs. So you go in and you maybe get 1 or 2 follicles, but just it's not real effective. You don't get a lot of eggs usually when you do that. I've had patients that have had myomectomies and we've done really well and been able to get ovaries. I've also had patients that have had myomectomies and unfortunately it gets stuck in a different place and you can't get to it from that way either. So I think probably I would recommend, if you were my patient, I would recommend doing a myomectomy. You might want to mention to your doctor that you're doing IVF, and some doctors will kind of tack the ovary, but yes, it's not very easy to do that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that every doctor would feel comfortable doing that, but just know that even if you have this myomectomy, there's a chance that they still may not be able to get your ovary if it gets stuck in a different place that we can't retrieve. So yeah, it's a little bit of a catch-22, but I think in the long run, you're probably going to have something done anyway, because it's going to be another good 10 years probably before you go through menopause and you may end up having problems with bleeding and pain and all that stuff. So if you think you're going to have it done, you might as well just do it now. And most of the time we can retrieve you. We may not want to transfer an embryo for somewhere between 3 to 6 months, depending on the type of surgery and the surgeon that does it. But we can still retrieve eggs really within a month or so after your more major surgery. Once your doctor's said that your incisions have healed up, then we can stimulate you and do IVF at that point. So we won't, you know, waste any more time.
I mean, the other question is, if you're getting about 5 eggs from that one side, do you plan to do multiple retrievals from that one side, use more of a min-stim protocol so you're not spending as much on meds, because you can get five eggs develop with Clomid, maybe a little hint of FSH there. And so it means you're going through more retrievals, but you work with what you have. And you never know when an ovary
getting two blasts
is really good
from five eggs. That is, that's like blowing the odds. So
yeah, it really is. You're right.
That actually makes me more optimistic. I mean, we are looking, you know, you know you're older, you know, there's a higher chance of chromosomal abnormalities. We're looking for that one good one. But the fact that you've had that is actually very favorable in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, and the fact that she had an AMH of 2.2, her doctor might even be able to be even more aggressive with the medicine. And even though they wouldn't get, may not get to one of the ovaries, they may still get
more on the one side.
Yeah. She may be able to get more.
Mm-hmm.
This sounds like one of those things of how much can you put up with, how much can you deal with, how many times can you go through this just to see if you can get there?
Yeah.
How deep is your pocketbook is the other one too.
Yeah, that's the other one.
But I would ask your doctor what your antral follicles are on your accessible side, you know, and mm-hmm. if you on average have maybe 8 or 10 antral follicles on that side, maybe doing a more aggressive stimulation to make the most of it and just kind of blow through it might be the best option. Also, sometimes the bigger your ovary gets, the easier it actually gets to become accessible. Mm-hmm. So if you only have 3 or 4 follicles on that ovary that's difficult to access, if you get more to grow with abdominal pressure and things that we can do while you're asleep that you otherwise wouldn't like us doing while you're awake, we can sometimes make those happen. And, you know, there's lots of times I start off with stimulation and I'm like, oh, the ovary's under the uterus. I'm worried about getting it. And once those follicles start growing, it just pops right back up. And so.
And like Carrie said, a bowel prep is really key to do a bowel prep. I've definitely had patients that we couldn't get to their ovaries until they did the bowel prep.
Yeah. All right. Very good. Here's our next one. Hi there. Your podcast has been super helpful as my husband and I face infertility. My husband, 29, myself, 26, tried to conceive naturally for about a year. After no success, we found that I had PCOS. As a formality, they checked my husband's sperm, and from a past injury, they found he had a low sperm count and 0 motility. Mm. This led us to our first round of IVF. They retrieved 23 eggs and 21 out of 23 were mature. Next morning, we called and got 0 fertilized. Our doctor said that it's rare to have 0 fert. They have suggested to try again where he will have a testicular biopsy done. Do you ladies have any input as to the rarity of 0 fert and also the step of a testicular biopsy? Is this the correct path to take? Thank you.
So I'd be interested to see what the viability of the sperm was. Sometimes when I have guys that don't have any motility, at least in that particular specimen, they can mix in pentoxyphylline and just see if they can see any quiver there to see if the sperm, any of the sperm are alive. And then they also, and they being the embryologist, can do a viability stain, and it kills that the sperm that they do the viability stain on. But, you know, one time I had a guy who, like, we found that like something like 60% or 70% of his sperm were viable. And just we figured with random chance, we would pick a sperm, even though it wasn't moving and we couldn't tell it was viable, would be viable. Now, based on this, it sounds like none of his sperm are viable, but I just wonder if they checked the sperm at all with pentoxyphylline, because sometimes if you mix in that and you can see a little bit of a quiver, even though there's not many sperm that may be viable, they could pick the ones that they knew were living, basically.
Or a hyperosmolar swelling test. I think our lab has done that in the past before, so you can see it and then use those sperm. That's another way of getting about the same thing.
Can you use the sperm when you do at the time you do the test? Oh, okay. Yeah, that'd be great then.
But I do think that, I mean, yes, a complete failed fertilization, I would say, is pretty darn rare in this day and age.
Yes.
Especially with your characteristics, too. Like,
right.
And
so I would say it's very rare. And I do think that doing the testicular biopsy, it is a very reasonable next step, because I mean, obviously you just spent a ton of money on meds, retrieval, all that jazz. And, you know, going through the testicular biopsy, you know, it's not pleasant, but I do think that sometimes we do get better quality sperm when we go upstream.
Yeah, I would definitely make sure that your husband has kind of a workup too. There's something called Cartagener syndrome that results in 0% motility. Although in that case, usually a lot of those sperm are actually viable. So I doubt that's what's going on, but he needs a workup. He needs chromosome analysis. He needs an endocrine and, you know, hormone test. And maybe he's already had that, but he needs to be evaluated by somebody too, because that's pretty unusual for somebody his age to have a low count and 0% motility.
And looking for someone to evaluate him, this is where it can be really helpful to find the subspecialist, meaning the male urologist who specializes in, or the urologist who specializes in male infertility and male reproduction, because most urologists, that is not their bag of toys. Mm-hmm. And they prefer to do different types of urology based pathology. And so there is a special fellowship that these guys go through, and they learn different types of techniques that not everybody's going to know how to do. And so these are the patients where I'm more likely to say, you know what, go down to Mayo Scottsdale, go over to UCLA, go to some of these specialty places where this is what they do, and they do it all the time. And so they're really good at zeroing in on what the problems can be.
And there aren't a lot of fertility trained urologists. You have a lot of urologists that will say they do fertility, but ask specifically if they are fertility trained, especially in this type of really unique situation. Okay. Because to me, it's the difference in going to your OB-GYN versus your reproductive endocrinologist, your urologist versus your fertility trained urologist. It'd be nice if they had a different name, kind of like us.
Yeah, but there's very few. I know in Tennessee, we probably don't have more than 3 or 4 that are subspecialty trained in infertility. So there's not many in each state. So you really want to make sure you get somebody that's had that training.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. All right. Our next one. Hello, my husband and I were diagnosed with male factor infertility. We recently had my first IVF FET cycle. The day of my embryo transfer, the lab thawed an embryo and it didn't survive the thaw. The lab had to take another one of my embryos to transfer and ended as a biochemical pregnancy. Is an embryo not surviving the thaw normal? Is this an indication that my embryos aren't, quote, strong, especially considering the second embryo implanted then stopped growing? I appreciate you all.
So embryos not surviving the thaw certainly happens. Some of that is dependent on what the characteristics were of the embryo going in and what type of protocols your lab follows. So there are some labs that will freeze absolutely everything, no matter what it looks like. Mm-hmm. There are some labs that are moderately picky, and there are some labs that are really picky, where they're not going to freeze anything that they don't think has a really good chance of going, of making success, because FET cycles are not cheap. They are not emotionally cheap or physically or any of those things. And so they don't want you going through it when they think that your embryo is just never going to make it. And so some of the answers to your questions are going to be dependent on what your center does and what their routine protocols are. That said, even in labs that are super picky, you know, the survival rate's about 95%. It's really good, but it's never going to be perfect. Mm-hmm. And so having to thaw a second one is not that unusual. It's unusual, and you guys should weigh in on this too, but I have had a couple of patients over the years where they make beautiful embryos, we freeze them, they thaw them, and the thawed embryos are just for crap. Mm-hmm. And they're one of the few cycles that we do that are really fresh cycles, or they're what I consider fresh frozen cycles, where you get them to a fertilized egg, freeze them, and then optimize her lining, and then thaw the embryo and just do a direct transfer. You can't do PGT on those, but that's something that I've occasionally done as well when I think that someone's embryos don't survive well through the freezing process.
Yeah, I think IVF has been around for so long. You know, a long time ago, the expectation was down here like, oh gosh, we're going to be lucky if we even have an embryo to thaw and lucky if we get pregnant. Now the expectation's like up here, like, why didn't it thaw and why didn't I get pregnant? And why did I have a biochemical? And, you know, unfortunately, it's not black or white. We're dealing with these little itty bitty microscopic embryos. And I would agree with Carrie, you know, back when we thawed and transferred embryos on day 3, you'd thaw 3 or 4 of them out and you'd be lucky if a couple of them would survive the thaw. Now these embryos have, you know, 140, 160 cells, and it's rare for them not to survive the thaw. But actually, I just had a young patient this week, kind of unexplained. We thawed a beautiful embryo and it just didn't thaw. And, you know, it's just, unfortunately, there's just things that we can't always have an answer for. I don't think it necessarily had anything to do at all with your biochemical pregnancy. I don't necessarily think that you have bad embryos unless the lab specifically said, you know, the second embryo that we thawed didn't look great either. In that case, then maybe it did have something something to do with it being biochemical. But otherwise, I just think it was kind of bad luck. And I don't necessarily think that it's going to mean that you're going to have, you know, bad outcomes going forward with any of the remaining embryos that you have. And hopefully next time will be the one that works.
Yeah, I would say that odds are this is correlation and not causation, in that just because you had two things happen, I generally think of an embryo not surviving the thaw is one of those unfortunate flukes that does happen. And biochemical pregnancies and IVF happen. You know, there's a lot that goes on after we put that little embryo into your uterus, and all the little signals that embryo has to send to the uterus and the uterus sends to the embryo, that there's just a lot going on. It's a very, very complicated process. And, you know, it's one of those that, you know, the miracle life of life is truly a miracle of life. And we help the process, but unfortunately we don't have it 100%. So again, we love having really high expectations of ourselves, and that's what makes us good at what we do. But it unfortunately, I think this may have just been two things that happened. So. All right. Our next one. Hello. First of all, I'd like to tell you how much I love your podcast and how it helped me along with my fertility journey. We've been trying to conceive for the past couple of years. We have done 8 failed IUIs, then we moved to IVF. Labs came back normal, FSH 9.4, LH 4.2, estradiol 36, AMH 1.73. First round of IVF did 4 vials of Menopur, then increased to 6 vials and low dose HCG of Novarel. Got 3 mature eggs and only 1 fertilized. Did FET on day 5, but didn't end up in success. Currently our second round of IVF and shortened being on birth control. Started at 6 vials of Menopur and low dose HCG. Still showing low follicle count on ultrasound. Anything I can change for next retrieval? Thank you all so much.
So she was on 450 of Menopur, basically, is what she's saying, I think, right?
Yeah.
On the last cycle. Did she give us her age?
She did not.
Her AMH was 1.73, but quite honestly, she, in my book, is kind of acting like somebody, unfortunately, that has an AMH that's lower than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What it tells me is you're just not responding really well. And unfortunately, we don't have a lot of great solutions for that. They increased your dose of medicine with the hope that it would make your cycle go a little bit better and get more eggs. And it really didn't turn out that way. Sometimes I'll also try an older protocol called the microdose Lupron Flare protocol, where you use microdose Lupron. So it's a special formulation of Lupron that kind of makes your brain for a few days produce your own endogenous FSH. So your brain kind of pushes out FSH. And then on top of that, we throw in, you know, more medicine on top of it. So it's almost like a 1-2 punch to your ovaries. Sometimes people respond better. Sometimes they don't respond at all. Sometimes they respond the same. And so it's kind of, when we pick protocols now, we tend to go more with a protocol like you had. But a lot of times, if I have a patient that wants to try it again, sometimes I'll switch to a microdose Lupron Flare, just because it's a little bit different medicines, a little bit different way that you get them. And every now and then I'll have somebody that will respond a little bit better. But I think, unfortunately, in the big picture, it's just your ovaries are just not responding well to the medicine, unfortunately.
I mean, yeah. I would not suppress you on OCPs. I would ideally do what we call an estrogen priming protocol, which about a week after ovulation, I give a combination of estrogen patches and cetrotide. There's multiple ways to do estrogen priming, but I would probably do that. I sometimes, in situations where it doesn't add up what your ovaries are doing, I'll do kind of about the same dose of the injectables you're doing, but add in some Clomid and Letrozole. And the combination of those in some poor responders really works like wonders. It was a protocol that I saw from somebody who's doing outside monitoring in my clinic one time. I'm like, wow, this is working really well.
So what do you mean by wonders? Works like wonders. Describe that.
People who, like, especially people who are, I mean, generally they're my 40 somethings, that when I give them injectables, they just don't respond. And I'm like, you have ovulatory cycles. Why, when I give you injectable medications, do you not recruit anything when, like, theoretically your brain recruits it?
Yeah.
But I do that plus giving the oral medicines, which are actually making your brain do what it naturally does,
but
literally on steroids. And I tend to have a better result in some of those people.
Which is an even older protocol than the microdose Lupron Flare. That's what they used to do way back, even before my time. I'm told that's what they used to do, is do a Clomid FSH cycle combined.
Mm-hmm.
I do. Sometimes old's not bad.
Yeah, I do a fair number of those, and really like like how they work, especially in someone where the rest of it has not, like all the routine protocols just haven't really worked very well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Good stuff. All right. Our next one. I'm 41 years old and love your podcast. After years of heartbreak, I met my life partner, 42, at 40. Tried to conceive for 6 months. Previous OCPs, no prior pregnancies. AMH 1.21, AFC 16. First semen analysis had 5.5 million, 32% motility, zero morphology. Repeat had 16.9 million per mil, motility 49%, morphology 1%. Partner was under a lot of stress prior to the first test. Had elective egg freezing in the U.S. at age 35. AMH was 2.38, 28 eggs harvested, 20 M2s frozen. Now live in Europe and wish for 3 kids, so plan to keep my frozen eggs on reserve for when ovarian reserve is lower. I want to do back-to-back egg harvesting cycles with ICSI and PGT, but my REI says that's not standard here and resistant. Questions are back-to-back, yes or no, and how many cycles, and any other further tests for him.
So how many frozen eggs does she have?
28.
Why does she not
have 20? She has 20.
And they were frozen when she was in her early 30s, right?
At 35.
At 35.
She's currently
41. Yeah, I mean, you can try to get pregnant at 41, but I would see what happens when you fertilize those eggs and see how many, you know, I realize you may be in a place where you can't do PGT. In this country, we would say, why don't you go ahead and fertilize them? I mean, he's your life partner. He's the one. So I would go ahead and fertilize them and see what you get, because it depends a little bit on what your life choices are. If you want one child and you have, you know, one or two or three genetically normal embryos, there's no reason you need to go back through another egg retrieval again. So I would go that route first and see what you get. Then at that point, if that doesn't work out, then you could start trying to stimulate. I just think at 41,
it's not going to take long to find that information out. That's going to take, you know, a couple of weeks to figure out if we have fertilization and normal embryos. And you may get enough embryos for those 3 babies from the eggs you already have.
Yeah.
And I would think even, I mean, most of the places in Europe aren't going to object to you doing this all with autologous cycles, meaning you, your eggs and your husband's sperm. And so I would think that that would be more achievable. Now, with respect to your question about back-to-back cycles, it really depends on the person. I personally am not a huge fan of them, mostly because when I do the baseline for the second cycle, there's still a ton of leftover resolving. And so I don't get results. And so like my standard is just to build in saying, okay, we're going to take a month off, let your body settle down, and then we're going to go into it again. And especially with someone who's got a follicle count of 16, like you're kind of a unicorn. And so we want to maximize that. And back-to-back cycles, it might be the right way. Like, you're probably not going to hurt doing a baseline, but I think you should probably be mentally prepared for, I will get better results if I take a month off, let everything simmer down, and then do it again.
Better to have those expectations than go in and get frustrated. And, you know, people, I always tell people when they come in for ultrasounds and there's a cyst, I'm like, this is not a bad omen, because I really feel like that's the first thing everybody feels. It's like, oh no, we're starting this off and it's already going bad. And it's like, it's not. These are things that normally happen physiologically. It's your body getting back to normal, and it's okay. And I know nobody wants to be patient, but unfortunately patience is sometimes the best thing you can have. To when we force things that are not necessarily supposed to happen at that moment, that's when we kind of get in not as great situations. Yeah.
There's a reason we do all these baseline tests and why we follow all this, is because if you're going to pick up something, you want to pick it up.
All right. Our next one. Hello, I'm 41, been trying to conceive for 2 years and completed one cycle of IVF with no pregnancy. Diagnosis is age-related infertility, no male factor, one previous miscarriage, one previous termination. AMH 2.24. We got lots of people in their 40s.
Wow, a lot of 41-year-olds with really good AMH.
Yeah. FSH 7. AFC was 7 in the right ovary, 15 in the left. I had 16 eggs retrieved, 11 mature, 9 fertilized with ICSI, and 4 day 5 blasts of 5AA, 5BB, 3AB, 2BB, transferred two blasts in a fresh cycle and then two in an FET. I'd like to know your opinions to see if there's anything else my clinic could be missing. From my own investigation, my test results seem very good, but I'm not having success in getting a positive test.
So you know, I think a lot of these illustrate is that because we've had three questions, I think, from 41-year-olds. And so that kind of tells you one thing that 41-year-olds just don't do as well. You may make, and as you ladies are showing, you have really good egg number, but we still know that at least 90% of your eggs are genetically abnormal. And I think that's kind of what you're seeing. I mean, it could possibly be that all four of those embryos were genetically abnormal, and there's no way that you would have known that without testing. So I think, unfortunately, this sort of illustrates that age, just even, you know, we even know when we freeze eggs in 40-year-olds versus eggs in 30-year-olds, the eggs just don't freeze and thaw as well. They're just not as good. And then one step further is the genetic component as well. So that may be kind of what we're seeing.
And one thing to keep in mind is that, you know, those embryos could be normal, okay, but we don't know that. And so if we know we're putting back chromosomally normal embryos, then we can kind of go down other rabbit holes to look for other uncommon things that could be wrong. But when we don't have that information, common things being common, I mean, the most likely explanation is that they were likely, at least some of them were likely to be abnormal.
And maybe all of them even.
And the other thing that I want to remind all of our other 41-year-old listeners is that the counts that we've been hearing in these last three questions are not typical.
No, not at all.
You're not broken. There is nothing wrong with you. You are
normal.
Probably very normal when you're looking at counts that are like 2, 5, 8 in those ranges, because that is more commonly what we see in 41-year-olds. So while it is absolutely fabulous, and I'm delighted for these ladies that their counts are just ridiculously high for their age, that's not really common. And so don't worry about yourself if those aren't your numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, there was a study done several years ago at AMH levels. And what you see is starting about age 40 is where the majority of people end up having an abnormal AMH at age 40. So abnormal would be under 1.06, basically. And all these ladies have had numbers that were 2 and 2.2. And that's what we tend to see in patients more like in their mid-30s.
Absolutely.
And younger.
All right. Our next one. First, this podcast is awesome. Thanks. I'm 34 years old with unexplained infertility, AMH of 6.37 in my first cycle of IVF. My question is related to clinical outcomes related to day 5 versus day 6 embryo transfers. Ultimately, we ended up with only one day 5 embryo, 5 day 6, 1 day 7. Knowing that some labs only culture to day 5, I'm started doing a PubMed search. I know, I'll stop. Comparing clinical outcomes of
you. Okay, we're kind of rolling 5. Our eyes right now.
At least it's PubMed and not Google.
It is true.
True.
It is
That's true.
I applaud you for using PubMed. Versus day 6 euploids, thinking that PGT would neutralize the difference, but it seems like the live pregnancy rates are still significantly less with day 6 embryos. Is that something to worry about? If you carry a day 6 to birth, are there differences from a day 5 baby? So
no.
The answer is probably no.
Yeah.
And that data, I think in some ways is center dependent. So I know that our center, we ran all the stats to look at day 5 embryos transferred on day 5, day 5 embryos transferred on day 6, day 6 transferred on day 5, and day 6 transferred on day 6. And they were all pretty similar. And so that's wonderfully freeing because it gives you the luxury of making sure that you have everything right. And so if you need to wait an extra day for whatever reason, you can do that without fear of, oh my gosh, something's going to break.
Right.
Go ahead.
I can say it in our system, really our day 5 and day 6 embryos are equivalent. And historically, we've seen a big drop in day 7 embryos, but probably within the last year or two that we have started on day 7 embryos that are hatched, or any that are hatched, but you're most likely to see hatched embryos as day 7, adding an extra day of progesterone has actually brought those up to pretty darn close to day 5 and day 6. So my first thing is don't get too caught up in embryo grading. Okay. If you have a chromosomally normal embryo, that can make an absolutely amazing baby, whether it's an AA, a BB, or however you grade them. So
I third and fourth, fifth that statement.
Me too. Yeah.
Embryo grading is something that we use to draw lines, but in all practicality, it's pretty much useless. Okay.
Well, and it has a basis though, because back before we did genetic testing, the only thing we had to go on was how pretty the embryos were. Now we know that that takes a big second, a back seat to the genetic part of it. The genetic part's way more important.
Exactly. So I wouldn't worry if you have a day 5 or day 6 embryo, and even your day 7 has a reasonably good chance of making a baby. So I think you're in a great position.
Well, another thing too, depending on when that article was published, still there's centers that don't do frozen transfers, they do fresh transfers. And back then, you had to account for that extra day because the endometrium would change in a way where it wouldn't match the embryo. The embryo would be at day 5 in development, but the endometrium would be in day 6 or 7. And so when you transfer an embryo like that, you don't have good pregnancy rates. Now, because we freeze embryos and we do program cycles, we transfer an embryo when it's equivalent to a day 5 transfer or day 5 embryo at the right time where it matches the endometrium too. So that's why we used to think day 6 embryos didn't do very well in fresh cycles, but they do perfectly fine in frozen cycles.
Mm-hmm. Y'all want to do one more?
One more.
Okay.
One more.
I'm 40 and began my fertility journey with a failed IUI using donor sperm in 2019. HSG showed a blocked tube, no hydro. So onto IVF. 3 retrievals resulted in 3 normal embryos after PGTA testing. Transfer 1 and 3 resulted in miscarriage at 7 weeks, heartbeat detected week 6 for both, and transfer 2 never implanted. Products of conception, both normal. Retrieval in fall of 22 produced 5 embryos, no normals after PGTA testing. All embryos rated high A's and B's. Tomorrow is day 3 of fertilization of donor eggs with new donor sperm. 2 normal hysteroscopies, slightly elevated BCL6, 2.7, perfect ER peak. Transfer protocol was intralipids, esterase, progesterone suppositories, progesterone oil, steroids, and adding Lovenox this time. Any other suggestions? Thank you.
No, you pretty much have the kitchen sink.
I think you've hit it all.
The only thing that I didn't hear in there was the 2 months of Lupron preceding it, especially if you have the BCL6 that's elevated.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the one other thing that I would say is worth adding in.
I agree. I think you literally are getting the kitchen sink, but I would say with the elevated BCL6, unless you've had the options for BCL6, and please correct me if I'm wrong, are surgery to remove the endometriosis or suppression by something like Lupron or Orlissa is what I think the next step is. Otherwise, you're getting great attention.
Yes, yes. I agree. I
would not agree with that.
All right.
Well, wonderful. Well, that was a very good episode. I really liked all those questions. They were thorough and covered a ton of area of material. So, all right. Well, to our audience, thank you for listening. Be sure to tune in next week for more. Be sure to subscribe. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We would love to hear from you. We're on Instagram. We're on Facebook. We're on YouTube. So hop on by, leave us a like or a follow, and say hello.
You can also visit us on fertilitydocsuncensored.com to submit specific questions. All the questions will be answered on our podcast for the Ask the Doc segment. We would also love episode ideas, and so let us know what you want to hear. We'll be anxious to hear from you.
As always, this podcast is intended for entertainment and is not a substitute for medical advice from your own physician. All right, we'll talk to y'all soon.
Bye.